This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joe Cohen from Queens College.
I'm Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University.
And I'm Gabriel Rossman from UCLA.
Today, we're thrilled to sit down with Vincent Roshigno, Distinguished Professor of Sociology at Ohio State. Vinny wrote The Face of Discrimination and The Voice of Southern Labor and is now working on Inequality and Power in Everyday Life with Polity Press. He's also chair of an ASA task force on first-generation and working-class sociologists. So we're going to talk about politics, power, the state, and maybe the plight of the non-privileged in our discipline. You're definitely not going to want to miss this. So I want to talk about a new personnel strategy at Southern Illinois University that I read about this morning in Inside Higher Ed. It looks like Southern Illinois is... Dean, one of the deans there circulated a note to department chairs about a new initiative to recruit alumni to be, quote, zero-time adjuncts, which is basically starting to staff the university with volunteers. And the idea is that they're going to start relying on volunteers for thesis committees, teaching classes, serving on committees, grant proposals, basically faculty. They're looking for volunteer faculty. And and on the face of it, it sounds like a win-win, right? The alumni give back, the university saves money, right? Students get access to people who are from the, quote, real world. And a volunteer alumni can say that they're faculty on their LinkedIn page, right? Win-win for everybody? Any thoughts?
Yeah, that LinkedIn page thing was actually what I was thinking. So when you first proposed this before I checked out the article, I was thinking maybe this was for like a professional school, where, you know, you kind of see a weaker version of this where you don't pay adjunct faculty very much, or practitioner faculty, as they sometimes call them. But implicitly, what you're paying them in is prestige, where they get to say, you know, my, you know, interior design business isn't just some interior design business. It's an interior design business by a professor of art history at Southern Illinois University.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think I don't know what type of business would you know, pay more for a consultant who could say they're at the sociology department or the anthropology department at Southern Illinois. And the fact that they are doing this, it sounds like campus-wide, really implies that it's just a pure cost-cutting. And then the other way I was thinking is maybe it could just be like a development move. Like sometimes I know that our development kind of has the idea that if you let people guest lecture, it gives them more of a sense of attachment to the university, and then they'll leave their $10 million estate to the university or something like that. But it doesn't seem like it's that at all. It just seems like they're saying the pure cost-cutting measure of let's recruit people to, you know, basically let's find a free substitute for one of our major cost inputs.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, I mean, I'm still trying to wrap my head around this, right? Because it seems to me that there are many PhDs/full-time faculty who actually have absolutely no idea how to mentor students, have absolutely no idea how to do many of these things that you're saying they're just going to get volunteers to do. So, so if you're not paying someone, can you demand that they actually have a skill set?
Well, you can't put much demand on anybody who's volunteering, right? Like, you're just happy that they're walking in the door.
Well, that partly depends on how many, right? If you're saying we want to get five volunteer professors, you might actually be able to get five who are highly qualified. And, you know, let's say somebody is a retired accountant and they just want to stay active. And so they want to teach a class, volunteering to teach a class on accounting. I would not be surprised if the university could get one person like that who's really good practitioner faculty, or they could be a younger person starting out. And like you said, they want to put on their CV or their LinkedIn page or something like that. But if you're trying to make this, because the article you sent around talked about a critical mass. Mm-hmm. And that they wanted this to be like a large scale thing. And if you're trying to do it at scale, that does mean you're basically just looking for warm bodies.
Vinny, what's your thoughts on this?
I'm not going to quit my job and move there to take one of these positions. You know, it's cost savings. I mean, the state of Illinois is in sort of huge financial trouble, the university, the public universities anyway. And, you know, they brought in this chancellor to sort of clean house and look for cost saving measures. And that means not hiring. And this is a response to the not hiring. And I have it on good word. There are other cost saving measures that he has proposed, which is public knowledge now, as far as I know. And it includes consolidating departments into schools to sort of trim down the faculty and trying to convince current department chairs to volunteer their time as new heads of these schools or as department chairs, volunteer their time.
So they don't get releases.
With no releases or compensation. Maybe one course release or something like that, but it's extraordinarily minimal compared to just about everywhere else in the country. A little bit ironically, this same chancellor has been caught up in a little bit of a scandal, including getting his daughter and his son-in-law hired at the university into administrative positions. At the same time, they're not willing to hire faculty. They're trying to get volunteer faculty. They're trying to get people to do service for their departments as chairs without compensation.
My first reaction to this story was that, well, here's a school that doesn't really care about quality or doesn't believe that, you know, experience will have a substantive impact on whether or not people are delivering good classes or they're getting positive student outcomes. Or maybe it's that they don't care. And I'm wondering, is that a trend in this business where sort of we have administrators who just feel like there is no benefit to having full-time faculty or you don't need it? You just got to put a warm body in front of the class.
Yeah, I would actually say, yeah. And you know, I've seen it at my university where they've been experimenting in not even having the warm body. I mean, you know what I mean? They're like, what we can do is we can just record your lectures and we'll just have them in perpetuity and people can just watch your lecture and we don't need you anymore.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, that's going on everywhere. Online classes, half online classes, sort of filling the seats, meeting the needs of the population somehow with fewer staff that have the credentials. Now, I don't think that, I mean, of course, there are, you know, Joe, you sort of raised that relative to the university care. I mean, a lot of these universities, including Southern Illinois University, have really great productive faculty. So it's not coming from them. I mean, it's definitely coming from sort of administrators that have a sort of coming at it with a business emphasis, filling the seats and collecting dollars from particularly undergrad classes.
I mean, if I think of my personal situation, I feel like I'm such a better teacher than I was 10 years ago when I started, and that experience definitely has a benefit to it. And I wonder if they have some type of Dunning-Kruger type of thing where they're not teaching and they're not researching and they just figure it's really easy. They're like, well, anybody can do it because they don't know what goes into it, right? And so they figure anybody could do it. They're like, well, I could run a big research project. No problem. I got my MBA from Wharton.
I welcome them to teach a mega intro sociology class like I just taught. And I think that, you know, they'll be shaken from all those assumptions about how easy it might be.
There's also that, and there's also the issue of, like, what is the university? Because it's becoming more and more of a credentialing process. Like, there must be some value to expertise, like, to having people with advanced knowledge and extensive experience. Like, I understand that you could bring an accountant in to teach accounting 101, but maybe there's some value to having people who are shaping the knowledge in a field rather than getting, you know, some retired practitioners who might have been last trained 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that's fine. And I think there are ways that universities can do that through alumni boards, having lecturers that are, you know, working. We have a lecturer in our, or we have had lecturers that have worked for the prison system, but with criminology, sociology degrees that come back and they really like teaching just, you know, one class a semester in sort of in a more applied format, but not the critical mass. mass that they're talking about at Southern Illinois University.
I mean, you know what it reminds me of is, you know, there's this idea in marketing that once you have an established brand reputation and client base, you try to cut costs mm-hmm. by degrading the quality just a little bit, something that is just so small that you expect most consumers not to perceive the difference, and you try to capture the extra profit. And the problem is there's a path dependency, right? Where you just keep on shaving it down and tastes get, you know, the quality deteriorates till you find yourself with, you know, little to show.
In terms I mean, there's a lag, right, in terms of prestige in most fields and most organizations. So they, I imagine organizations and institutions can sort of live off that prestige for to a certain point, right? There's got to be a critical juncture where there's nobody left and everybody is, you know, or you know, universities are all teaching their courses online. And it just seems,
And then only the kids going to Harvard are going to be able to interact with experts. Small disclaimer, we lost Gabriel halfway through that conversation.
Yeah, I just want to distance myself from whatever socialist nonsense these guys were ranting about.
All right. What's next on this slate, Leslie?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I've been following this story for, I guess, a few weeks now. It's a couple of weeks. So, yeah. So the New York Times had an article, I want to say it was on the front page, discussing the plight of, I think, you know, this generation of Caribbean migrants to the UK. People who migrated to the UK from like around like 1948 to around 1971. And during this time, they're called the Windrush generation because of the ship that, you know, that took them from their islands to the UK, primarily, you know, to London. And I guess since 2012, when Theresa May, who is now the prime minister, but at the time when she was home secretary and decided to usher in these very, very tough immigration laws, making it really, really hard for people to get jobs if they didn't have particular documents, I think one of the unintended consequences, although quite a few Black Britons are saying that maybe it wasn't so unintended, was that these people who migrated to the UK during this point in time, when I guess in effect they were UK citizens because you know they were part of the British Empire, you know, they were from the colonies, and they were actually encouraged to come to the UK and England in particular, helped rebuild after World War II. And basically since 2012, it seems that people from, you know, who came from the colonies, you know, up until 1971, they're having a very, very difficult time working, you know, getting access to healthcare, among other things, and actually some are actually being subject to deportation. And this all came to a head, I think, was it earlier this month, when leaders of former British colonies, you know, came to London for a Commonwealth meeting. And I guess they called Theresa May on it, and she had to apologize, and she made a pledge to actually try and right the wrongs. And so that, in a nutshell, is the story. And yeah, I just thought it was a very interesting story, especially given our conversation with Gene Beeman last week.
It reminds me of DACA, kind of, right? Is that... It's somebody's in a gray zone, and I guess what happened? They weren't officially citizens, but they were sort of de facto treated like citizens for years.
Yeah, well, I mean, because number one, they were encouraged to come to the UK, right? I mean, and they were British dependencies at the time. Like many of these island nations were not island nations yet; they had not. They weren't independent, right? So they were still part of the British crown. So, you would think that would mean that you were de facto citizens, right? But I guess not.
That actually strikes me as knowing nothing about British immigration law. This, although I'll pretend to be an expert, you know, that actually strikes me as a stronger legal claim than the DACA recipients who.
Much stronger.
Yeah, because the DACA recipients, you know, may have some moral claim or some sympathetic claim, but, you know, prior to Obama's executive order, they had no legal claim whatsoever. So, whereas, you know, there was actually some ambiguity. There was a policy of benign neglect for decades, which is what created the situation. But, you know, in theory, the law never allowed any claim whatsoever. But, you know, you're saying that, you know, prior to, you know, the decolonization, but even before that, right, prior to decolonization, you know, so when did most of the Caribbean colonies become legally autonomous from Britain, the 60s?
Some of the bigger ones in the 60s, and then many of the smaller ones then followed suit in the 70s.
Okay, so if the, you know, period of immigration was all mostly in the 50s and 60s, right, then like you're saying, these people would have migrated at a time when they were, you know, members of the same polity. And then this, you know, period of, you know, Commonwealth, even though, you know, of allied nations, but not strictly speaking citizens of the same polity, until very recently, so which, you know, like you're saying, it's actually a stronger claim.
It is. So it seems to me like it's kind of a bait and switch, right? Although, I mean, I think yet again, I mean, and maybe it's, you know, kind of my habit, the bad habit that people tell me I have of actually giving people the benefit of the doubt all the time. And that perhaps, you know, in 2012, when this happened, it actually was, this had more to do with sort of the large number of Eastern Europeans coming, not just Eastern Europeans, but like people, no, not Eastern Europeans, because they would have been part of the EU, except for the ones who aren't part of the EU. But there were migrants coming from other parts of the world at that point in time in large numbers. And I think that that's what the Home Office was responding to. And they weren't necessarily thinking about these, you know, these Caribbean migrants who'd been in the country for decades, right? And at the time of their migrating, didn't need papers because they were like, oh, well, you know, you're from Jamaica. You're kind of one of us, except not one of us. And yeah, and so this policy that was intended to curb quote, undocumented migrants in the UK from getting certain benefits, from getting housing and from having jobs, it then unintentionally affected this.
Well, that's a common thing, particularly in Europe, where you'll see a policy that is intended to basically, you know, do something often of symbolic importance to a disfavored group, but they write the policy more generally and then it ends up affecting other groups. So there's been a lot of policies in Europe that have basically been designed to, with the intent of reducing the visible Muslim minority. And but the policies are written facially neutral and they end up affecting Jews too. So, you know, you could like them on their own terms or not. That's kind of the point. I'm just saying that it's similar in that a group that is a policy that is intended either to solve a problem with some group or just to harass some group ends up having a problem, creating issues with other groups. So, you know, France has ratcheted up its laïcité laws, you know, which everybody knows are basically, you know, in practice, laïcité just means militant secularism, but, and they've had those laws since the revolution, but they've been ratcheting them up lately. Everybody knows that they did this in order to keep people from wearing hijabs in public, but they wrote them in a facially neutral fashion so that they end up limiting the expression of Orthodox Jews. Many European countries have passed laws against ritual slaughter, which are intended to basically harass halal butchers, but end up also harassing kosher butchers. So, you know, you see that same type of thing where there could be a longstanding and more or less favored minority, and then there's a new disfavored minority and people write a law to you know, harass and or solve an actual problem with a new disfavored minority that ends up affecting the old favored minority incidentally.
Yeah, and it seems to me another thing that this has in common with some of the things that we've been seeing, at least here in the United States, is that when Theresa May was called on it, she blamed the Labor Party. Yeah. And then they dug, and then they did a little bit of digging, and they were like, "Oh, actually, this was a policy that was written when you were Home Secretary." She was like, "Okay, my bad.
Yeah, so,
passing the buck."
You know what? I'm thinking about is sort of the evolution of the institution of citizenship in England, in particular, but maybe more globally. Because didn't the British have this idea that if you went off to fight with ISIS, that they would revoke your citizenship? And I remember that discussion or that policy existing a few years ago, and to my mind, that was sort of a desanctifying of the institution, right? It made it, rather than something that once it was given to you, it was yours forever. It became sort of like a privilege, citizenship. And I wonder if this is another unintended consequence of our war on terror.
Well, I mean, it reveals the fluidity of immigration and citizenship rights sort of over time, which is that they can change on a dime. Relative to you know, political decision making is a little frightening right now. Mostly because, I mean, if you think about the refugee crisis going on around the world and immigrant flows, immigrants searching for places to live, these issues aren't going away. I mean, this article that Leslie was talking about is just fascinating. I mean, the case in point they bring up is this guy who's been in the UK for 50 years. And you know, and now they're saying, no, you don't belong here anymore. And I don't know. I mean, even, you know, Mexico, sort of the extent to which documentation is necessary for migration, even in and out of the U.S. for migrant workers, ebbs and flows over time. How restrictive it is a sort of a political decision. And it has to be frightening for these populations.
Yeah, we're in a period where everybody's sort of trying to expunge the others from their society. Like the interesting thing in that story was that one of the people had a passport that said they're a British subject and a citizen of the colonies.
Yeah,
like, nope, sorry.
Well, I do think it's interesting, and somebody brought up a little bit ago that this seems to have possibly been in reaction to the massive increase in intra-EU immigration over the last 10, 20 years, which has kind of led to a backlash against migration in the UK, as in many advanced democracies. Mm-hmm. You know, that seems to have been tied up with the policies of the politics of Brexit, where there was a notion that it wouldn't necessarily reduce immigration overall. It would just redirect it from intra-EU migration to intra-Commonwealth migration. But this doesn't seem to have followed that theoretical payoff of Brexit.
And now we turn to Vincent Rechigneau from Ohio State. Vinny has a long and impressive resume and is now working on a new book, Inequality and Power in Everyday Life, with Polity Press. He's also a former editor of ASR, and he is now chairing an ASA task force on first-generation and working-class sociologists. We got a lot to talk about. Thank you for joining us, Vinny.
Hey, thanks for having me. Happy to make it to the annex.
Well, you know, I mean, ASR... And was just, you know, the warm-up act, right? I mean,
well, you know, I was thinking about this, and I could be ASR editor, I could publish an article in AJS, but nothing is as cool to my 19-year-old as being on a podcast that you can download it from iTunes. That's cool.
Well, so, Omar keeps asking me, when can I go on? When can I go on? And I'm like, hold your horses. You know, you haven't quite worked up to that level yet, right?
Well, my daughter thinks my podcast is the least cool thing in existence. So,
wait, less cool than Lean Cuisine and listening to Wings?
My kids aren't on Twitter, so they don't even know about that. That's Daddy's secret.
Yeah. Daddy's dark secret, second Daddy life.
I spend my afternoons eating Lean Cuisine and listening to Wings. All right. Vinny, let's start off. Let's talk about your new project coming up, Inequality and Power in Everyday Life. What's the project about?
You know, I've been studying inequality, different kinds of inequality, and across different institutional domains, especially, well, politics, work, education for a while, and I'm sort of diving into this project as an opportunity to try to put the puzzle pieces together from these sort of different types of inequality, different institutional domains I've been focusing on, and I have the opportunity now to sort of try to pull it all together. I think it's partially a reaction to specialization within the field of sociology, which you know, I appreciate for sort of its empirical value and empirical analyses, but I am a little unnerved by the fact that, you know, sociologists of education don't talk to sociologists of culture, don't talk to sociologists of work, et cetera, when these institutions obviously play off each other. There's also, you know, some unease with the lack of conversation between inequality-oriented sociologists. That is, you know, some focus on race, ethnicity, some focus on immigration, some focus on gender, you know, some focus on social class or LGBT issues, et cetera. And they're not having conversations with each other. I think there are certain, although there are certainly unique dimensions to those types of inequality, I've always been haunted, you know, just despite, you know, the good advice of my advisors to pick one area of sociology and focus on, just publish on that one thing for the next 40 years. I've always had a sort of an unease with not trying to pull it all together. So this book, Inequality and Power in Everyday Life, is that attempt.
I remember the last time I used to love the concept of power. I remember reading up on it when I was an undergrad. Stephen Luke's, I remember, and Dennis Wrong. But I also remember that I haven't really heard about the topic. I remember not reading up much on it in graduate school, and I don't see much about it. Why don't we talk about power more? It's so central. But we don't explicitly theorize on it.
Yeah, it's hard to get our hands around. I mean, even a lot of inequality scholarship, you know, sort of resorts to sort of analyses of group differences, which again is fine, or you know, human capital differences that explain inequalities in this or that. And I think it's unfortunate that especially inequality scholars have lost sight of power. And I think part of the problem is that power operates at multiple levels, right? It operates at a sort of societal level. If you think about the state and who has disparate say over the state, happens at institutional levels, happens at organizational levels, and then happens on face-to-face levels as well. So the complexity of it, and how it matters relative to inequality is really hard to get our hands around, especially, you know, during the contemporary era of sociology where you know, you have to write a journal article in 30 pages and you have to put together a singular sort of empirical analysis. If you're talking about sort of power and inequality at a societal level, there's no way you're going to do that. So I think that's part of it. It's complex, but I think, you know, to our demise, we're ignoring how power and culture and power are implicated in the reproduction of inequality.
Have we gone much further than Stephen Luke's over the past, I guess, 40 years now, right?
Not too much. I mean, there certainly are social, psychological, and experimental sort of analyses of sort of interactional power in experimental settings. But, you know, Luke's was talking about, you know, big power, big P power at sort of the societal level. And I haven't, you know, seen much. I mean, I've gone back and have read what, you know, the articles you've mentioned. I've gone back again, you know, to Weber. And now more recently, I've been really diving into Gramsci. I'm having to go backwards to sort of look for these big statements on power and why it's meaningful. Now, there are within more specific literatures, you know, Joan Acker and talks about power in organizations and gender and masculinity. Du Bois certainly talked about race in particular, and institutional power at some level and its consequences. So I'm really struggling with it, but it's actually, you know, it's totally terrifying to try to undertake a sort of broad theoretical project like this. But at the same time, I think maybe sociology needs to sort of move out and think big again.
Do you think that maybe power is too big a concept? It's sort of like social structure,
yeah.
Right? Or is it possible that it's too big to theorize? Or do you see sort of a path to victory, or maybe a path towards useful conceptualization?
Yeah, I've always liked sort of big theory, as long as I can see avenues by which one might test elements of that theory. So I think one could come up with a perspective on power, or hegemony, or whatever terms you like, and apply it to particular institutional domains or organizational practices, et cetera. So I think it is too big for any singular analysis, for sure. But that doesn't mean that we can't sort of theorize it in big ways that might be informative to more meso-level analyses.
Let's talk about empirics. Can you share with us sort of any examples of empirics that you feel are very revelatory, right? That really stand as a really good way of exemplifying the dynamics or character of power.
I think there are really great case studies of sort of power, top-down sort of power dynamics with really serious implications for inequality. There are, at sort of a societal political level. So I've done some work on, like the Wounded Knee Massacre or the subordination of Native Americans sort of historically, and how power at the state level combined with sort of culture and legitimation to sort of allow the federal government to subordinate, essentially resulting in the reservation sort of era that we still live in. But then there are sort of meso-level analyses. I mean, Charles Tilly's book, Durable Inequality, at some level is about power, although it doesn't tend to use the concept of power so explicitly. Wieden and Grusky's work on social closure in particular occupations, and how certain status groups sort of hone in and protect, and by default are excluding others. I can keep going on and on. And then of course there are really, Linda Mulm's sort of experimental stuff on power and the interactional sort of dynamics, how status matters in everyday encounters, how it gets activated either implicitly or explicitly to sort of reify existing arrangements, I've always found fascinating. So there are different. I'm sort of methodologically all over the place in my answer to your question, because I think you'll need different kinds of methodologies depending on the level at which you want to sort of understand power distributions and practices of power and domination.
Yeah, no, I think this sounds like an amazing project, and I actually can't wait to read what I hope will be a not more than 500-page book, right? Although, given I'm especially a fan of your work in education. Mm-hmm. So given how good that work is, if this is anywhere near as good as that, I think I could sit through more than 500 pages. But one of the things that I actually want to get back to is the point that you made, Vinny, about how, we are meant to specialize, and we are meant to focus on this very, very tiny, portion of, of scholarship. And one of the things that I've been finding, for example, in trying to figure out what race means and how it operates, right? Like, you can't just stay looking at one institution.
Right.
You have to look across multiple institutions to see, you know, where the logics, you know, tend to click together. And you're like, aha, right?
Yeah.
This is how it works, right? And I think it's the same. It's the same with trying to figure out what power is. It's the same with trying to figure out what any of these big concepts that we as sociologists are meant to be concerned with and meant to be, you know, basically defining.
Totally, totally. And I promise, actually, the book's going to be 200 pages or less. That was the pitch. That was the pitch I made to Polity, is that like my favorite moments as an undergraduate and a graduate student in sociology were reading those kind of small paperbacks that were filled with theoretical ideas. You know, Tilly's book, like Why, among others, you know, Peter Berger's Introduction to Sociology. This little paperback probably left a deeper impression on me in terms of my sociological thinking than any particular article. And I'm an article writer, so no insult to the article writers out there. But you're right. I mean, this probably I could never decide, even as a graduate student, what exactly I wanted to focus on. I was looking at, you know, economic inequality and published some articles in grad school on economic inequality and race in the South and sort of the constellation of race and class dynamics that were going on simultaneously. And then I remember telling Don Tomaskovic, DV, my advisor, that I now want to focus on education for my dissertation. And he looked at me like I was a little crazy, but he went with the flow. And, and you know, and I studied education, but it wasn't just education I was able to focus on because, you know, educational inequality by race or by social class is also partially a function of, you know, geography and where you live and the politics of the place you live. It's also a function of what happens in families and what's going on in your parents' employment, right? So these institutional domains are interwoven with each other. And I think that the danger of sort of super specialization in the field is that, you know, we end up with useful snapshots of what's going on in a particular domain, but the danger is then you're implicating that one domain, maybe like education is where all the problems of racial inequality sort of come from, which we know is not the case.
Exactly.
Right. So, you know, this is, I'm sort of trying to go back now. This runs counter to where I think some rewards lie in our field. You know, if you're an assistant professor and you're going up for tenure, and this is sort of one issue I had, you're going up for tenure, you're expected to put together sort of a research statement, right, to send to the external committee that sort of describes a unifying sort of agenda in your work. That is, you're supposed to have a sort of a specialized focus in it. So in some ways, this is a sort of a dangerous thing I'm saying, right? Think bigger, when in fact the expectation is that you will sort of hone in and specialize in your career, let alone, I mean, how many of us have time to sort of read across multiple literatures, multiple types of inequality, multiple institutional domains. So there's a heavy startup and some potential dangers in doing this.
Yeah, totally.
But I feel like I'm maybe at a point in my career now. Well, what the hell? Let me try and see what happens. But I think the field would benefit from more efforts in these regards to sort of think bigger. And again, power. It just has sort of just fallen by the wayside of a lot of inequality discussion, which is troubling. Mm-hmm. And it's also the case that really we've done an absolutely lousy job at integrating culture and belief in our discussions of inequality. In part, I understand it. They're very hard sort of to capture. You know, how does culture and belief impact, you know, the persistence of race or gender inequality? But, you know, man, look around the world around us. I mean, we were just talking about the incel group, right?
Yeah.
How do we make sense of that? What's going on? You know, what's going on culturally or in terms of people's beliefs? And we know these are important for the way people, you know, treat other people on the street, how they treat people in organizations, how they go out and vote at the end of the day. And so we need to bring belief and culture back into it. So I'm adding on to the interinstitutional focus by suggesting that, we need to do a lot better of a job. And that's where sort of Gramsci sort of came in to my rereading and rethinking of some of this. You know, he does balance out sort of old Marxist traditions, which are much more materialist emphasis, by suggesting that, you know, there's a lot of action in culture and belief. And that pertains not only to class, which is what he was talking about, but to race, ethnic inequality, or gender inequality.
I'm hearing you talk about power and what I consider to be different forms of power. So, you know, you talked about like Linda Bohm's experiments, where that's basically measuring dependence, where, you know, I have two potential trading partners, so I can play them off against each other, you know, effectively, an experimental operationalization of Emerson 1962, and the kind of thing you can measure with Banasich 86. You know, and then I also hear you talking about like status. And when I hear status, I think of like, you know, especially in the context of understanding status as power, I think of like, you know, Gould's model, where when someone is of higher status than you, you will accept only partial reciprocity. If someone's an equal, you expect full reciprocity. And if someone is a subordinate, you expect super reciprocity. So, and then, you know, and then on top of that, you're talking about Gramsci, you know, with like notions of like cultural all that sort of thing. And I'm sure we can add in, you know, closer to the Gramsci thing, we could talk in like Bourdieu and cultural capital, also kind of a cultural notion. So yeah. To what extent do we gain anything in a sort of intellectual monism of understanding these as all just special cases of power? And to what extent is it meaningful to think of them as having completely different micro-level heuristics that in some cases may cut against each other? Basically, are you a lumper or a splitter? Or, you know, if you want to think of it another way, are you taking kind of an intellectually monist idea? Or are you just creating like, here's a menagerie of different forms of power, and they're all interesting because they all ultimately get you stuff?
Well, I think at the moment I'm a lumper. Uh-huh. That is I'm at least in this particular project, I want to try to work my way down from the sort of societal to the institutional to the organizational to the sort of interactional. Now that doesn't mean that I've sort of always been there. Actually, part of the reason I wanted to engage in this project is I've been doing a bunch of work over the last 10 years on sort of discrimination and sort of status dynamics as they happen in real workplace environments or in housing, et cetera. So the initial insights to the relevance of power actually began at this sort of micro level, not in an experimental sense, but in a sort of archival or sort of real world sort of account sense of how discrimination happens. I'm starting from the top down. I'm lumping them together. I mean, I do think there are elements of power that might counter one another, but I'm looking at the I think the more general trend in particularly class inequality, race and gender inequality. And I do think they align more than they splinter.
Additional questions on power and inequality? Or should we move on? I want to talk about the task force. Yeah.
Oh, you don't want to ask about some R&R you got 10 years ago and that you're still mad about?
You can ask. That's great.
All right, let's do that. And then I'll bring up all my beefs about why I'm not an ASR. So first, Vinny, let's talk about this. You're chairing an ASA task force on first generation and working class sociologists.
Yeah.
This sounds really interesting. Can you tell us what the task force is about?
Sure. This task force came about through some prodding of the council by a number of ASA members. I actually wasn't one of the people that prodded for it, but it sort of intrigued me. You know, there's a lot of work going on right now both within the sociological literature, the educational literature, but also sort of policy work that universities are doing on first generation students. You know, they're not likely to go to college, they're less likely to finish college, et cetera. And I'm engaged in a project on that as well at my university, but the task force itself, the goals are to, number one, to sort of, you know, at least at the basic level, define what we even mean as sociologists by first generation. Do we mean you know, people that whose parents did not have any college? Do we mean working class people whose parents worked, you know, blue collar jobs? Do we mean low income people, et cetera? And we're trying to tease that out because there's actually not a really good definition in the first place, even among universities and how they activate or use the term. So that's sort of one of our tasks, and we're trying to come to some consensus regarding that. But the sort of bigger issue or questions that I think are at stake are whether or not there are, you know, mobility problems, particularly in our profession, relative to those from working class or first generation backgrounds. If there are, where are they? You know, how do people sort of navigate this new terrain of university or sort of faculty life when they're not used to it, and it can seem sort of overwhelming, if not alien to them. And so what we're going to be doing is a lot of things. Actually, beginning this year at ASA, we're going to spend a day doing focus groups with both members of ASA and sociologists, at least in the Philadelphia area, that are not as actively integrated in the profession, that we're going to try to sort of recruit in for the day, to just do some brainstorming with them over what sort of the issues are in their professional lives, in the mobility or lack of mobility they've experienced, you know, resource, are they experiencing sort of resource problems, et cetera. That's just sort of an initial qualitative undertaking. And then sort of following that, since this is a 3-year task force, I'm going to be busy for a while, as will my 15-member committee, who are awesome. We're going to be surveying sociologists probably within a year, all ASA sociologists. So we have some sort of comparative reference, but we're also going to be recruiting in sociologists who are at like community colleges, for instance, who might not have the resources, energy, or integration into professional societies like ASA, as well as graduate students, about problems they've experienced or blockages in the pipeline, et cetera. I mean, it's a you know, I was just talking about institutional, you know, dependence and inequality. And, you know, there's not going to be a sort of a simple answer to what's going on in the mobility prospects. And then following the survey, we're going to be doing in-depth interviewing with hopefully a relatively large sample of respondents to sort of dig deeper and see what other kind of either tangible issues they're experiencing or social psychological issues about fitting in, belonging, garnering positions within the field, you know, visible positions within the field.
Well, I mean, I don't want to push you to speculate too much, but I'm going to. From the outset, what do you feel the issues are? I mean, if someone, you know, gets their degree and they happen to be from foreign born parents or a working class parents, what are you missing? What you know, how does it disadvantage you concretely?
Well, I mean, we know how it disadvantages, you know, people even earlier in the process from sort of the emerging literature. I mean, as I said, they're less likely to go to college in the first place, let alone finish college. And at least if we think about those that want to go into grad school in sociology, they're probably disproportionately going to go to less prestigious programs, in part maybe because, you know, like the SAT and ACT, they're probably if they were family disadvantaged, they're going to have lower GRE scores, you know, from the get-go, which we know is sort of a, you know, gatekeeping tool into the more prestigious grad programs. Often there might be sort of resource disadvantages that they experience, student loans and debt and the need to get a job, et cetera. And, you know, that sort of compounds inequalities later down the line. If you graduate from a department that's, you know, 75th in the country, the odds of you getting a high prestige job in the field or going to graduate school in a department that will sort of nurture the kind of vita you need to get a high prestige job in the field has got to be lower. So there are this sort of tangible mobility issues that I hope we can tackle, but also there's a broad literature, not only on obviously first generation working class people, but on minority people about just fitting in a place that seems totally alien. I mean, you're going to have less of the sort of, academic cultural capital from the get-go.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, and basically just to chime in as someone who would maybe be a good subject for your study. just to chime in, I could see there are instances where you don't end up in a less prestigious program, but you, when you are in these prestigious programs, I mean, I think that there is language that is taken for granted, right? And I don't mean the kind of language that, you know, that means that you wouldn't get a perfect score on the verbal component of your GRE. I mean, I got that locked down. But just academic language in terms of, what are comprehensive exams? Right. Like, how does this happen? How does that happen? And I think that there is actually, like, very, very often, unless you go to your director of graduate studies, unless you go to your committee members and say, hey, you guys do realize that I'm like first generation, right? And you should maybe give me, when I ask you questions, you shouldn't think that I'm stupid. Yeah. You should just think that maybe I'm just like, I haven't been around this kind of academic culture thing before.
Yeah. It takes a lot of bravery to have that moment, right? First generation students are reluctant or will tend to be reluctant to sort of reveal where they're from, because they're trying to fit in, but doesn't mean they're not going to experience that uneasiness, right? And, you know, I suspect, you know, we will, you know, on the one hand, when we're looking or as we're looking at sort of mechanisms of discomfort and or sort of inequality in the mobility process, and a couple of committee members have also talked about the possibility of doing some in-depth interviewing, at least with some of the outliers, some who have made it through the pipeline in successful ways. And what was it? What were those? I mean, we're not used to doing this in sociology, right? We don't study the outliers. But it may be worth looking at. Was it a sort of a key mentor that you felt comfortable talking about or revealing who you were and where you're from along the way? Was it good interactions and relationships with a cluster within your cohort where you could sort of share your vulnerabilities and seek advice and figure out what comprehensive exams are without fear of embarrassing yourself in front of the whole grad cohort, et cetera.
So I have kind of a devil's advocacy question, and I'll preface this by saying it's been like 20 years since I've seriously studied stratification sociology, and so I'm probably messing something up. But when I was studying it, I remember learning that there was an article, I believe by Mike Hout, that established that after you get your bachelor's degree, the net effects, like family background affects whether you get a bachelor's degree. It's a huge influence on whether you get a bachelor's degree. But once you get the bachelor's degree, there's minimal net effects of family socioeconomic status. So assuming that I'm remembering that correctly and assuming that it's still valid and hasn't, doesn't apply to recent cohorts or something, that would imply that for this entire population we're talking about, right? Because we're, by definition, more or less talking about people who finished their bachelor's degree, because we're talking about people who are either in graduate school or have completed graduate school. Right. That would imply that we should expect to see relatively weak effects of family SES background.
Yeah.
But doesn't that depend on the outcome that you're measuring in terms of the effect of family SES?
Yeah, I think he was looking at status attainment or income or something like that.
Right. And I think it was also people with bachelor's degrees that went right into the labor market. And I know there's some debate over those findings and whether they still hold that are sure. going on right now. And, you know, I wonder, you know, I'm open to any possibility, but I wonder if there are not sort of, and there's not an extra layer of a sort of prestige dynamic, resource dynamics that go into those who keep going. I mean, comparing those who get their PhDs, you know, where did they go to school? What kinds of, you know, work related outcomes, status related outcomes do they experience? I think I hope the field is open enough to sort of take a close look at itself to at least assess whether or not there are sort of blockages in the pathways of these populations. But I'm familiar with Hout's article.
Yeah, I just think it's an empirical question. Yeah, and I'm just saying that article would lead us to believe that there should actually be fairly minimal effects. It's an empirical question, one that's probably worth asking. Yeah. But
It could be. And, you know, having the right kind of comparison groups and having, we're having these just sort of biweekly discussions about sampling. How are we going to do this survey? So we're comparing, the right people. What kind of markers of success and status do we have? I mean, probably when we survey, we'll ask for people's vitas too, so we know what their pathways were, what their publication records look like, kind of who got the good book contracts, who didn't get the good book contracts, who got into ASR, who didn't get into ASR, who became a department chair or, head of this ASA committee or that ASA committee, et cetera.
Wait, is that kind of service work a good or a bad outcome?
This is sort of the debate. I was a little worried. Michelle Lamont asked me to chair this committee, and I sort of thought to myself, so kind of like Committee on the Status of Race Ethnic Minorities and Committee on the Status of Women. Yeah. So you're going to take some productive people, really productive people in those groups who have some visibility, and you're going to keep them busy doing a whole bunch of bureaucratic work for the ASA now, that's not good. We're going to make, policy suggestions that the ASA might have workshops, once we know what the sort of findings are. But we're also, a good number of us on this committee are planning on publishing in reputable social outlets out of this data we're gathering. I mean, this is really, we're engaging in a pretty monumental data collection sort of effort about our field. But I think the implications will probably carry over to some extent in other fields, certainly other social science fields as well.
Yeah, it sounds like it'll be interesting. And, I was giving some reasons to expect that you might find the null, but even if you do, that would still be interesting to know.
Totally. I want to know what the storyline is.
All right. And maybe before we let you go, Vinny, one last question that I think a lot of listeners will be wondering about. You have some great experience as editor of ASR. Yeah. What have you learned through that process about writing publishable papers?
I'm still editing a journal, so I haven't gotten to put it in practice yet. No, I think, I didn't expect this question. So you,
we can drop it.
No, leave that.
Or is it really just the question of write good articles, like write something new, write something good?
Well, if you write, I actually think one thing I've learned sort of along the way, aside from, having the sort of the empirics, right, and interesting and, if not groundbreaking in your article, good writing matters. And this has sort of bothered me for a while because we sort of drill into our graduate students like crazy in their programs. You got to take this methods class, that methods class, this methods class, that methods class. Mm-hmm. But we actually don't train our graduate students in writing, like clear, concise writing, which I think is a shame because I think those types of articles that are well written, but also potentially groundbreaking and make the case and sell themselves well, tend to do better. in the review process. I mean, readers are sort of intrigued. So I would say, you know, good sort of concise writing, man, and keep at it. You know, rewrite. Get feedback before you submit it.
Well, can I let me suggest something, and then you tell me if it's your consistent with your more extensive experience editing than mine, which is the single most important thing you're going to write is the cover letter. Not in the sense of, oh, here's the abstract all over again, or not in the sense of like the kind of boilerplate of it would be a privilege to publish in your journal, but just in the sense, if you're writing to a general interest journal, of saying, my work speaks to these two areas. Here's a list of suggestions of 10 possible reviewers, and make it 10, not 3, so that, you know, they can choose from it without worrying about compromising double blind. Because what I found that does is it tells the editor, or more to the point, it tells the managing editor, right, who's typically a grad student. Here's the reviewer pool who will know how to appreciate my research and don't pick up on some surface similarity that's misleading and send it to someone who's totally inappropriate and therefore won't like it.
I don't know about that. I mean, I'm sure different editors have sort of different takes on it. I've always been relatively hands-on, sort of reading, you know, the intro and the abstract at least, and sort of figuring out, you know, who might be appropriate reviewers or not. And I think for you know, generalist journals, you know, the big generalist journals, sometimes it's worth the time of an editor to pull in a reader, a sort of a broad reader, but somebody who's maybe not as specialized, because there are specialty areas within our field that are really pretty small.
Yes.
And you figure them out pretty quickly as an editor. You know, I mean, it could work to your advantage, but it could also work to your disadvantage if there are 8 people in that particular sub area and 4 of them hate the other 4. You're kind of screwed in the process. So, you know, I certainly would look and have, you know, historically looked at, you know, cover letters that suggest reviewers. I'll certainly give them a good take, but I also would worry a little bit as an editor that, you know, the author's trying to stack the deck a little bit, to people that they either know the paper or they think will like the paper. So, you know, I think good editors mix it up. They'll take, you know, they'll look at your suggestions, and then they can take them or leave them. But I do think actually, relative to at least part of what you said, I think, man, abstract and introductions are the most important thing for getting the kind of reviewers that you want. Because you think about it, you know, an email from a journal saying, would you review this paper? And the first thing you do is you scroll down and you look at the title of the paper in the abstract and you make a decision, right, about whether you want to review it or not. And if the abstract looks interesting, relevant, provocative, et cetera, you're more likely to say yes.
Yeah.
If it looks like it's just, you know, boring, then just leave it alone. I don't have time for this. So in some ways, you can create sort of a bit of a positive self-selection on your paper if you really are do a good job on the abstract.
Yeah, I personally the work cited section first, but that's because I've read Joel Podolny. But I agree with you that most people go to the title and the abstract first, and that's how they get their idea of whether this is a paper worth reviewing. Yeah. And also, even if they agree to review it, just what sets their expectation of like, oh God, this is going to be a slog, or oh, I'm looking forward to see what this has to say.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. A special thank you to Vincent Reshigno of Ohio State. His upcoming book is Inequality and Power in Everyday Life with Polity Press. We're on the web, theannexpodcast.com, on Twitter at SocAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producers are Anika Chowdhury and Joshua Rivera. On behalf of Leslie Hinkson and Gabriel Rossman, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.